All right. Thank you very much, Jorge. I'll get started right now, and this is actually, as others have said, a repeat performance for those of us who were invited by Jorge to the Soil Water Conservation Society meetings in Chicago earlier this year. It was a very intimate room there, and so we asked Jorge to get a larger room for us, and I think he's done very, very well at that task. So. Today, I want to acknowledge my co-authors, and then I'm going to launch into a bit of a ramble, which is meant to be reflective. I was told after the last time I gave the talk that I kind of soft-pedaled it, and so I ramped up. And now, with Wayne Honeycutt in my sights, I'm going to actually go the reverse direction and backpedal. Okay. I want to acknowledge first my co-authors, Doug Smith, Kevin King, Andrew Sharpley, who's in the audience right now, Doug's also in the audience, Laura Johnson, and I've added Dave Baker because you'll see a number of slides particularly related to cover crops that Dave's provided. And I hope that you take what I say with a grain of salt because my entire worldview is around phosphorus. And so it's important, I think that's really the message today, is that when we go and manage one component of the system, we should not be surprised when there are consequences in another area. So today I'm talking about Lake Erie, where a number of my co-authors work very closely. It made the headlines this summer because Toledo was without drinking water. They had a no-drink, no-boil mandate for a period of time, affected 400,000 people. Lake Erie is best seen in the context of history, and that it's one of the great conservation success stories. It's a nutrient management conservation success story. And so it was, one of the motivators for the Clean Water Act. We saw tremendous experimentation in terms of addressing point sources and non-point sources for CRP, which was discussed earlier. It's one of the classic case studies for how you can address sediment using government programs. And so it's important to look at everything we talk about today in that light. And that also makes it more distressing then. So here's the 2011 algal bloom. It was a very, very wet year. And you had a couple thousand square kilometers that were in a cyanobacterial bloom. And that was the cause of that prohibition for drinking that I mentioned earlier. It's a very shallow lake, so it responds readily to inputs. There's rapid turnover at the west end, but that's also the end where you have the majority of your agricultural inputs. Here's some data from Laura Johnson, a co-author, that show three watersheds and trends from 1975 up to 2010. And what you see now, that long-term decline in total phosphorus that I showed earlier, there's an inflection. So in the mid-90s, you start to see an uptick in the agricultural watersheds, whereas the Cuyahoga, predominantly urban watershed, forested watershed, doesn't have that uptick. So agriculture is definitely part of today's current concern, which is the dissolved phosphorus concern. What makes it even harder to deal with is the fact that if you look at the specific yields or the loading rates to the lake, that they're very, very low. We're looking at less than 2 kilograms per hectare. So this is not just about massive loads that we can run in and quickly target. We're talking about small loads that are really insidious in nature and that add up. So this was basically the positive side, and this is my concluding slide, which is that we have to take an all of the above strategy. We also have to leave at home, I think, our agendas and our preconceptions when you're dealing with very, very acute problems like this. And traditional conservation strategies, while they're incredibly important, they don't solve the dissolved phosphorus problem. And this is a no-brainer for somebody like Andrew Sharpley, who's been publishing on that since the 1970s. So you think about the period of time that we've known a lot of what I'm about to show you, and how difficult it is to convey to a community that to some degree is polarized and in a state of denial. So the kinds of things that you'll see experimented and are right now being actively tested are things in stream, edge of field, all kinds of great filters, great work actually with gypsum application. And then I will touch upon a little bit the 4R strategy because I think that's really critical right here. But what motivated me actually even to volunteer this talk when Jorge asked me to give it was a report that came out on Lake Erie about a year ago. And it's generally an excellent report that covers the entire landscape. But what surprised me was that you had an emphasis right off the bat on a couple of sacred cows. And I think it's important to recognize them as sacred cows. Cover crops and no-till as they contribute to soil health. And I extracted from there this particular statement here. And it goes on, I'll just read you the top part. It gets worse, actually. Once the soil is healthy and has good water infiltration and water holding capacity, it may be possible to surface apply fertilizer, knowing there will be little to no water runoff, and that nutrients will infiltrate and percolate through the soil via matrix flow. And so this is the general statement that's the guiding principle behind a management strategy, which really does not apply to the issue of dissolved phosphorus right there. And in fact, it's erroneous. So let's start with the first of the sacred cows, cover crops, which are tremendously important. They're incredibly important in all kinds of settings. In the world of phosphorus, if you don't control erosion, you don't control phosphorus loadings, okay? But when erosion is controlled, then you can look for other things. And cover crops are critical to that soil conservation component of it. These are tremendously flat landscapes, particularly those that are closer to the lake. And there's been a strong push to invest in cover crops. A few years ago, Andrew and I had a student come from Norway who was observing with some of her watersheds there that there was an uptick in dissolved phosphorus associated with watersheds where they implemented catch crops, which are essentially rye cover crops. And so she did her dissertation with us, and the first thing she did was she looked at what happens with senescence and freeze-thaw cycles of a cover crop in terms of the release of water-soluble phosphorus. So you can see right here what she went in and out, in and out of a freezer and took her samples and essentially extracted phosphorus in water the more time she went through a freeze-thaw cycle. So yes, those plant cells, when they're lysed, do relieve dissolved forms of phosphorus, and those can contribute to runoff. In fact, Andrew did a study on this in the 1970s again. So she then went on to use a very controlled type of design where she, she used pack boxes like this and actually established the rye cover crop in them. And we compared what happened before and after the boxes were taken in and out of a freezer. And originally they're fairly low concentrations of dissolved P and runoff. And then after they were frozen and thawed, you can see the concentrations go up. So this is just consistent. Now we're looking at runoff water instead of water that's been used to extract directly from the cover crop itself. So let's fast forward to today. Heidelberg University, where a couple of my co-authors reside, Laura and Baker, is very actively involved with monitoring the area. And in the Sandusky River watershed, they've taken advantage of a targeted watershed approach within the larger Sandusky watershed to do basically a paired watershed comparison. So Honey Creek was the locus of adoption of cover crops and winter wheat. They're combining them together, and they were applied starting about 2008 to about 13% of the land area. This was a project that involved a number of partners. And what they did is they monitored over time and compared what they saw in discharge from Honey Creek with discharge from Rock Creek, and which was essentially their control, where you didn't see this adoption. If you look to the left, this is sediment-bound phosphorus, again expressed as a concentration in discharge, and then this is the relationship of Honey Creek here to Rock Creek, and the blue line is the relationship before application, the yellow line after. There was no effect of the cover crop adoption and the winter wheat adoption on sediment-bound phosphorus or particulate phosphorus. But when you looked at dissolved phosphorus, what you saw was afterward that the slope indicated greater concentrations in Honey Creek relative to Rock Creek, which was the control. When you look at that on a load basis, this is a specific yield right here, you see essentially the same thing, that there's no difference after implementation. That's what they started targeting things was at the yellow line for sediment-bound phosphorus. But for dissolved phosphorus, you start to see this divergence. And so they're hesitant right now to completely attribute it to the cover crop. However, what you do not see is an improvement in the dissolved phosphorus load. And in fact, you see trends that are consistent with studies that have been done elsewhere. And so I think that's one of the points, is that most people won't believe what they don't see in their own backyard. So there's an aspect of denial to these studies because it's very, very hard to observe dissolved forms of nutrients running off your land. They just don't show up. So our approach, our modern approach to phosphorus management is really one of following the concept of the Pareto principle in economics, the critical source area identification. We try to target to areas where a source of phosphorus is activated by some type of a transport area, and that's what we call the critical source area approach to phosphorus management. And in flat landscapes, such as what you find around Lake Erie, there are some differences that I think have to be considered and have to be brought in to our discussions, and they're very difficult because they involve drainage, and drainage is central to our production systems there. So we have flat landscapes that are internally drained largely. You can see, I just took this from Google map right there, and you can see some areas in which they're essentially depressions or internal drainage. But there's a tremendous amount of tile drainage that has been implemented in the past and that continues to be installed in the past. And there needs to be a consideration of the fact that that drainage provides some hydrologic conductivity. And it can get very difficult to talk with colleagues about this because it is such an important agronomic practice. And so here's just an example. There's those internally drained spots that were really disconnected from the ditch originally, and then I put in a hypothetical a drainage pattern right there, herringbone, to connect that. So that's what I'm talking about. And the critical source area now, instead of being a minor area of the landscape, becomes much larger. We don't just look at very small areas of the landscape. So when that happens and you have highly hydrologically connected systems, what you find is essentially it's the flow that drives the losses. This is from the eastern shore of Maryland where I do a lot of work. We monitored some drainage ditches, and the top is the precipitation. And you can see the strong relationship between annual precip and the flow. And so I have not figured out yet how to manage precipitation. So what we can do is we can emphasize very important conservation practices like controlled drainage. Controlled drainage is really, really something that, you know, addresses the concept that we did not optimize our drainage systems to hold back water, that we do have excessive drainage, and this provides us some modicum of control over those flows. But it's fractional in terms of its contribution. It does not wipe out the complete contribution that comes from a new tile drain. And we have to recognize that as we get into this, that it's an important practice, but it does not expunge that connectivity. So part of what's contributed to this, I found out, is certainly the commodity prices that we've had in the past few years, which are, you know, changing now, but also increasingly the purchase of tile plows by farmers, which make it very, very affordable, or relatively affordable, with quick payback to do installation with one's own equipment. So the installation of tiles, actually, when people think of tiles and phosphorus, they don't really think of phosphorus as moving through the subsoil, but in essence, tile drainage and phosphorus loss there is just surface runoff that's been routed to those tiles. Here's some data from tiles that Kevin King monitored for several years in the area, and you can see a strong relationship between the phosphorus that's in the upper 5 centimeters of the soil and dissolved phosphorus in drainage. And this is just straight up, you know, monitoring data. You can see some variance there, but a nice relationship, which is consistent with what we see in overland flow. And so here again, you look at the blue line is your hydrograph, the red line is your chemograph, flow versus dissolved reactive phosphorus. And you see signatures that are characteristic of overland flow, where your concentrations, your peak concentrations in the dissolved phosphorus are tied roughly to peak flow, and that changes a little bit with these events. This is from Honey Creek, incidentally. And so Marty Schipitello of ARS is now in Ames, Iowa, did some great work with Frank Gibbs where they really convinced folks about this connectivity between the surface and the tile by going out and pumping smoke into tile drains and then mapping out where the smoke emerge from the surface. And what you see is within a meter or two that you have a direct connection through primarily biopores, something that you want to promote. Yep. So these are things, though, you can address with the 4R strategy, with going, and I'm going to walk a little bit into those 4Rs as I wrap up right now. But it's different because instead of talking about overland flow, we're looking at subsurface flow. Here's Honey Creek again. The top is the discharge of the hydrograph. The bottom is dissolved phosphorus. And Laura Johnson basically recorded when the custom applicators were in spreading fertilizer. It was broadcast application. If you look at the dates, we're also talking about winter application here. And you can see a correlation between the timing of the custom applicator presence and some of the peak concentrations that they see at the outlet of the watershed. Here's a little work that we did that I wanted to bring in terms of, so that is the timing, and adjusting the timing relative to when you expect the transport to occur. From the standpoint of a placement, really, you're looking at putting that phosphorus in contact with the soil. I didn't have a good example for fertilizer, which is the primary issue certainly in Honey Creek and not manure. But what you see here are some studies where we looked at leaching of phosphorus, and we compared before with then after we either broadcast dairy manure or incorporated with tillage. And you do get, these are simplistic slides, I didn't put an error bar on them, but there was a significant difference in terms of that because you're actually mixing that source into the ground, putting it in contact with the soil where it's sorbed. Right now, the dominant method of application in that area is broadcast application, and predominantly in the fall and the winter. And then rate, of course, is another one, and adjusting those rates is very much a part of the 4R strategy. These are data from the 70s when Stu Klausner was looking at the effects of dairy manure application over tile drains in New York State. And so the 4R strategy very much applies to controlling the dissolved pea issue in Lake Erie, but it has to be adjusted for the drainage issues. And so this is my almost a second to the last slide, and this gets at tillage. One of the previous authors talked about the super weeds and really tiptoed around recommending tillage. It's one of these things, particularly for a conservation audience, that is not met with a lot of applause, let's say. So tillage, though, has its role, and it cannot be seen as something that is anathema to nutrient management and conservation, particularly when we think about the vertical stratification of nutrients that occurs when we do not till. We apply to the surface generally, and we get an accumulation in that upper veneer that is the primary source of phosphorus to the flow path. And so here you have some data in which Laura Johnson went out to a watershed, which was predominantly rotational till. It wasn't even continuous tillage. And what you see is what happens when you sample to 8 inches where you're mixing. This is kind of simulated tillage with excellent mixing. You get a 36 malic 3P, which is smack dab in the optimum range there, versus if you stratify your soil sampling in this here, there was about 50 fields that they sampled, and you can see that at the surface on the right, 60 parts per million malic 3P. And so in that area, you have a linear relationship between dissolved P in concentration and runoff and the phosphorus in the soil. So simply by tillage, you can more or less halve the concentration that you might see in runoff, and that includes drainage from the soil. So I think tillage has got to be on the table, it has to be dealt with in context and in place, but it can't be something that we're too hesitant to put forth as an issue. So my last slide is this. This is from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. We have very high phosphorus concentrations, and we basically worked for about a decade to draw those phosphorus levels down in the soil just through harvest. Without any tillage. We could have brought those levels down with tillage overnight, but at the end of a decade, essentially, we had not gone anywhere in terms of our malic free phosphorus. And our concentrations and ditch flow from adjacent those plots stayed the same. And so I think if we're looking at trying to do things on a timely basis, we've got to keep all of our options open. So I'll end with MERC 36 paper on the unanticipated consequences of purposive social action, and I think that we all have to be aware of that as we go out and advocate from a particular perspective. Thank you.
Is there a quick question for Peter?
Could somebody repeat it so I can repeat it? I didn't get that, Andy. Yeah, okay, so the question is, in this particular sampling, continuous no-till and rotational no-till were all lumped together, and we could go into that particular data set. What we do see is fairly rapid accumulation at the soil surface with any type of a broadcast application. So you can see that in a matter of years. With continuous no-till, of course, rather than slowing that rate of accumulation over time because you have some mixing and some disruption, you continue going up. And so they do separate, but I don't know about that data set. So Marty.
No, we need to. I'm sorry, we need to go to. Thank you, Peter.